Hey everybody, David Olson from Megadeth here. And hey, Doughboy's Bizarre Tournament for Super Smash Bros. Ultimate is going to be one you're not going to want to miss. Be there.
You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.
Well, hey there, everybody. It's me, Joe Thrashenkill. You're listening to another thrilling episode of the Toilet of Hell radio show. And I'm back. With two very special people. I know that on individual episodes in the past 3 months, I might have said something denigrating towards one party or another. All of those things were in jest, because with me today, I've got both 365 Days of Horror and Brennicide. Fellas, how you doing?
I didn't listen to the last show because I don't like this show, so...
It's probably for the best that you didn't, because since we did the show last week, not a moment has gone by that I didn't have Bastards by Machine Head stuck in my head.
Fuck that. I just think we should have a moratorium on Machine Head forever, for everybody. Just no more talking about them, no more listening to them.
It's better for our mental health. Brenna, Jordan, did any of those sweet tracks get stuck in your head this week like they did mine?
No, just in one ear and out the other.
I envy that. I really do. Because every couple of moments in my day, I say to myself, I look out on the world today and say, what a bloody mess. It's a huge, huge suck on my mental health. Anyway, we got things on this show. We got things that we've been doing, things that we've been preparing, and we're going to get all to it. But first, let's do a quick roundtable since we haven't all been together in the same virtual room in a very long time. Do we need to air any beef out?
The only beef I have right now, and I apologize to anyone listening, but my neighbors have decided to install a new sound system today and just listen to the exact kind of trunk rattling trash that everybody who has a new sound system in their shitty, dumb Japanese car has to rattle around in.
Did you ever put subs in the back of one of your cars?
Me? Why? Yeah. No, I mean, it gets loud enough. The only thing you can do is just put those subs back there to... that's really only there for the detriment of other people. That's specifically installed to annoy the rest of the human populace, and no other reason. It's not for your personal enjoyment.
Yeah, I put subs in the back of my first car.
Right, because you wanted to curse humanity at that age, right? Because it happened years ago, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, at the time, like, some of the most popular acts around were, like, you know, crunk rap, like right. Lil Jon and shit.
It's like the flaming dog apple for your neighborhood, except just on a much higher budget.
So, you know, it'd be fun. You would listen to, one of those artists, and then, you know, I would switch CDs to, like, I don't know, Coheed and Cambria, and just, it would sound awful, just like a rattling of horse shit all around in my car. And I was like, huh, maybe this wasn't the smartest thing I could do.
You could have been all I wanted.
Good eye, sniper.
Subs, very stupid. Very stupid thing to do, and yet they're very popular. No, that's cool. I'm glad that you're listening to the latest chart-topping hits, at least one bandwidth of it from your neighbors. You're getting exposed to the young people's culture.
I need pills I'm not supposed to take legally.
That's tight. Jordo, what's going on? What are the neighborhood kids doing to piss you off?
Existing.
Yeah. They have a way of doing that.
Being loud, shooting off their fireworks, you know, the usual.
Yeah, man. We're at today's the 11th of July. So like last night at 1 a.m., they were shooting off mortars again. It's like, no, this is over. You need to leave the 4th of July behind, man. Look forward to New Year's. I read a book for this episode, as I threatened to do occasionally. We can get into that in just a little bit. I went out and I did that thing that we've been talking about for a while, like for the past year and a half, that that we wish that we could go to shows. Well, I fucking did it. I went to a show. Leif Berikson came down and stayed with me, and we went and saw a heavy metal show. And boy, I tell you, it was an interesting experience. It's something that we haven't been able to do since this dang pandemic started. Am I right?
How was it? Who was it? What'd you see?
We saw the Eternal Champion with Vowska and Scourge. Basically, it was a constellation of bands that had been associated with either Iron Age or Power Trip or both over the past few years. And it was great. It was really great going out and seeing some rocking and rolling bands. This was at a venue that I don't believe had ever done a show on this scale ever before, because it was sold out at this this brewery on the south side of town. When we showed up, I got there an hour before the first band was supposed to go on, and I was stuck in the street in a line of about 600 people.
Oh my God.
So this venue didn't, you know, they knew exactly how many tickets they sold, but they couldn't figure out how to get people inside the venue in any kind of orderly fashion.
So it was like those videos of Japanese police officers shoving in money men and workers into their tubes.
Yeah, no, when I finally got to the front, the security guard was like, "What the fuck? Why are there so many people?" And it's like, dude, you know exactly how many tickets were sold to this.
Oh, he doesn't know. He's just some poor schmuck that's on the payroll.
Yeah.
They just gave some guy a yellow t-shirt.
Yeah, that is factually true.
They just text the wrong number saying, like, "Hey, Mike, you're working tonight," and he has no idea. And then he gets a pissed off phone call 2 minutes after he was supposed to show up.
Yeah, he was expecting to work the typical brewery crowd, which at this place, like, it's got a big, like, playground for kids in the backyard. I assumed he would be a much chiller time.
Shaking down little kids, yelling at them, "You're gone!"
So it's a very nice, very appealing looking brewery that I pissed on the side of because I had to wait outside for a fucking hour. once I got in, there was a nice sign inside that said, "No moshing, no crowd surfing, no aggressive behavior. You will be removed from the venue," or whatever. I can't say that I've ever seen one of those outside of like the CD insert from my like 2003 Ozfest CD.
I've seen them at venues, but they're always ignored, and the venue knows they're going to be ignored. It's just they do that for, you know, so they don't get sued when someone inevitably gets kicked in the back of the head.
It's a liability thing.
Yeah. Okay. We told you not to mosh. Sorry you lost all your teeth.
Right.
Yeah, so I did see some people, like, you know, taking pictures next to the sign and then immediately going forward and drop kicking someone. it was very fun.
It's like, that's where your skateboard is, in front of the no skateboarding sign. That's how it's exactly. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, authority. Fuck you.
So were there any COVID protocols or just wanding people in? Yeah, come in, doesn't matter.
I mean, like, if you consider, like, getting patted down and going through a metal detector, yeah, there were COVID protocols.
Metal detectors?
Yeah, I know. What the fuck, right?
It's fucking
these
fancy.
People had no idea what they were doing.
What is this, an E-Town Concrete show?
Seriously, Jesus. Instead of just like a bunch of chubby nerds that like have been listening to the same 10 bands for the last 5 years.
Were they going to have the show in the fucking sky? What do they need a metal detector for? Who's going to shoot absolutely. Anybody at a metal show?
Rest in peace, Dimebag Darrell.
Yeah, absolutely absurd stuff. Anyway, heard through the grapevine this particular brewery is currently under investigation by the Texas Workforce Commission for management stealing tips. So do with that information what you will.
Right.
But bands were good. It was really nice. We saw a friend of ours that we hadn't seen in a while, one Michael Greylord. He was selling Conan novels at the merch booth. including some of his personal collection. It was good seeing folks. It was good seeing music. Music's back, folks. That's what I'm hearing. I'm hearing that music's back.
Not for me, it's not. I'm not going to that shit.
Yeah, you're not gonna check out, like, you know, the latest. I'm trying to think, like, what's happening in your area right now, and all I can think is, like, either beatdown hardcore or, like, clean chorus metalcore.
I think that, yeah, it's clean chorus metalcore for sure. Like, I think the thing Jordan and I had brought up was Shadows Fall is reuniting at the Worcester Palladium with, like, all the bands from early 2000s that we pretended not to like in high school. So maybe I might go to that. I don't know.
It's almost sold out. You better get your ticket.
And then I won't. I'm not like competing for space. Forget it.
All the 30-year-olds in a 300-mile radius are going, so you better hurry up.
I better hurry up and get a sitter then, I guess.
That's one thing that I've actually noticed is that every show that I've seen announced, if you're somewhat curious about it, maybe might want to go ahead and buy tickets because shit sells out immediately now. People are starved and they're trying to get their fill. I think this is very temporary, of course. Once people are back in the swing of things with their lower back hurting like a motherfucker, they're probably going to stop doing that. But for right now, they got a Jones.
But it's like if everybody's buying tickets with such fervor and I'm kind of like cautiously considering it, it's like, do I really want to be in this space with these chuckleheads who will not respect like what happened last year, will not respect my personal space, and will just not respect like their nasty mouth germs getting sprayed everywhere? You know, it's, I don't know. Maybe I'm fucked up. I'm traumatized now. That's me.
I understand completely. I feel like I have maybe more confidence than I should in my vaccine, but I feel like I'm comfortable to go out there, especially to an outdoors venue, and just, you know, not cough in anybody's face and hope they won't cough in mine.
Yeah, I think I probably just have to jump in the pool there in terms of my immune system. just start swimming, motherfucker.
Yeah, what's really going to suck is when you get, like, mono the first time you go out.
Yeah, there's, like, other stuff besides COVID-19 that people don't think about, and we've been doing that shit all the time anyway. How about you, Jordan? Do you feel any differently? Are you going to go back to shows anytime soon?
Nope.
Yep.
Nope, not going to happen. Probably not this year unless something amazing is announced and is conveniently within a short distance from me for driving. But other than that, I doubt it.
I just want you to know, Jordan, that you are letting the scene down.
Good.
By not supporting your local bands.
Good. Let me just tell you both something and everyone listening. If the scene dies because of something I did, I'm gonna fucking smile. Like,
if it dies, it dies.
It's right. Have you guys seen who's in the scene? Like, I'm going to put that on a shirt. Have you seen who's in the scene? That's a good one.
When one local metalcore band breaks up, two take its place. It's like Hydra.
How did, was it Hercules? Like, how did he defeat the Hydra in the end? Was it just like by not going to his pay-to-play shows?
I think he said he was interested on his show on Facebook and then didn't show up.
The Hydra is like sending passive aggressive text messages to him, like, what the fuck, dude?
Yeah, you can't cut off his head. You have to break his heart.
Wasn't there a hardcore show a couple weeks ago that was essentially in an unhoused camp and fireworks were set off and it was a whole big mess?
Man, I
Gulch, that was the band.
Yeah, I wanted to actually talk about this on a future episode, and I don't have my materials in front of me because, boy, do I have strong opinions on that.
Next week.
We'll revisit next week. Gotta say, not a fan. Not a fan of how any of that went, so you can look forward to that on a future episode. This episode, though, I read a damn book. I believe that I was actually texting both of you guys when I went to Half Price Books a few months ago, and I was taking pictures of the various biographies in the music section. He's like, what do you think? Should I read Fieldy's book? You guys were like, I don't care. Please stop texting me. And I was like, what about the guy from Lamb of God? Should I read his book? And you're like, please stop texting me. I'm like, oh, what about the bass player from Megadeth? Maybe there's something interesting there. And like, I don't give a shit. So like, I bought that one, right?
You should have bought all three and just read all of them.
Just like, well, one the good news is those books will still be there when Joe goes back in a couple months.
I'm the only person buying these.
I'm convinced that like the least interesting member of the band writing a memoir is the only kind of book at this like half used books place now.
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, if you're looking for an ancillary player in any major band, their biography is there. along with roughly 7,000 books about the Beatles or the Rolling Stones.
Right. And it sounds like we're not going to get too much into the news today. And as I was looking through, I noticed that heavy metal's least interesting man, Frank Bello, the bassist of Anthrax, is going to be writing his own memoir. And I can't imagine the twists and turns involved in that.
We really need to tell bass players to stop writing the books. I mean, you're barely in the band as it is.
Yeah, there's like this plugin you can get now called like Easy Bass or something.
I got
you
it could the just, other day, yeah.
Yeah, you could just like have bass play on your mix without a human being doing it. And then if you do that, if everybody does that, there will be no more heavy metal memoirs, and that can't be anything but a good thing.
I bought the plug-in with that exact thought in mind, like, you know, doing this right now will prevent another shitty bass player biography in the future.
Right. Just doing your due diligence for mankind.
The Frank Bello book, I can't imagine that's going to be any good. I'm probably going to pick it up in 7 years when it's at my Half-Price Books. And we'll go through this whole process again. We'll talk about like why bass players are unnecessary and why their books are boring, and we'll do the whole thing.
But hey, I mean, look, it's going to be half price in 7 months. Let's make that very clear. But okay, let's get into who we're talking about today. So you have this memoir in hand from a one David Ellefson, someone who has been making some rounds in the metal news in the last couple months, I'd say, right? So
yeah, it is the timing is kind of funny because I bought the book and then I went back to reading Our Band Could Be Your Life for those bonus shows that we did. By the way, you should listen to those shows. I worked very hard on them.
Where can people find those shows?
How about you just Google Patreon and Toilet of Hell, because I don't know the URL off the top of my head. But you'll get there. You'll get there from that. Those are the bonus shows I did for the lot. I did three solo episodes covering this massive 700-page book. I don't talk nearly as much shit as I do on normal episodes because I really like this book and I really like the bands that are covered in it. And I think it's a really interesting book. So, you know, you could do that or you could just read the book. Either way is fine. I'm happy either way. But if you want to give us money, you should, you know, give us money. So I sat on the book for a couple months while I finished the other book. And then by the time I had revisited it, old David Ellefson hit the news, you know. There was some rigmarole. There was some nonsense. There was some horseplay.
Shenanigans, tomfoolery.
Shenanigans, if you will. That culminated in him getting kicked out of Megadeth again.
Yeah.
I will say that having read this book, I find what happened even more surprising, oddly enough. When you read an artist biography, almost it's a 90% shot that their book is about how they were a fucked up addict and they spent a lot of time getting into their really odious behavior and kind of glorifying it a little bit before, you know, coming back around. But like getting sober was the best thing I ever did, you know?
And now they're really into golf.
I will say David Ellefson's book is different. And that he talks a lot about his struggles with substance abuse in the book. He doesn't ever do anything close to glorifying it or giving what I would consider like a funny anecdote about, you know, some of the madness during those times. It's a very sober book in both ways. You know, it's a very serious book, and it also focuses like on all the things that he's been doing over the last many years to focus on sobriety. Including like his relationship with the church and stuff like that. So if you're going into this book looking for a funny story, you're just not going to get it. That makes it, in my opinion, a very bad book to read. If you're looking for like advice from somebody who was very successful when they were very young, developed a debilitating addiction and then beat it, this book's okay, I guess. I'm not interested in that though, you know.
You have suggestions for other books that are probably better for that exact purpose. So it's kind of like, why read this one?
If you are a huge Megadeth fan who is interested in getting sober, this is probably a good book for you. That's it. That's all I've got. I assume that that market's not entirely small, so the book makes sense to exist, but it's pretty limited.
So, all right, let's get into the book. I mean, you were telling me that as you're reading this, you made some notes in terms of stuff you wanted to share about the book on the show. If it brings us up to time, great. If it doesn't, we got other stuff to talk about too. But let's get into it. Let's talk about this book.
As we all know, like the story with Dave Ellison is that there was some video leaked where he was jerking his gherkin online with someone that was very, very young, though I believe of age, right? Did we ever verify that?
Yeah, she was 19.
They were 19.
Well, she's a young age, but legally it's fine. I guess it's cranking time.
Dave, or as his contemporaries in the music sphere call him, Pastor Dave.
It's never a good song. Not that's your nickname.
No, not great.
And it's not like being ironic. It's like, oh, look out for this guy. Here comes Pastor Dave. Right. It's like, no. That's Pastor Dave. Don't curse around him, guys.
Pastor Dave has spent a good many years in his sobriety era, like as a church leader and, a sobriety coach, and is overall very much into Bible stuff. So definitely stuff. Not an ironic name. It's worth noting that Pastor Dave has children that are older than 19, so that's a little bit icky as well. And in terms of, I guess, rock star behavior in this book, it is a very Puritan book in that Dave spends a lot of time doing things like cocaine and heroin, but he doesn't ever mention outside of like one or two relationships anything related to sex. So I find, I guess, the whole thing even more shocking that would be the news story that popped up. I don't know if you guys bothered to like learn anything about this character before all of this stuff. Did you at all?
Well, back when I was a young kid, I was listening to Metallica and Megadeth and things like that. And I wanted to be a bassist because drums weren't really working out for me. I wanted to actually
hard.
Drums are fucking extremely hard to be good at. Anyone who's a good drummer is like is a phenom. Please treat drummers well. But I picked up the bass because I really liked how I would look up tabs on the internet and play a note and I'd hear the fucking song as I figured it out. It's a little harder to do that with drums. So, I was just kind of looking into, all right, who are the people playing bass on my favorite songs, my favorite records, things like that. So that's probably how I was introduced to the name David Ellefson, is I was looking at buying his very tacky, stupid, like Scorpion bass guitar that he used to sell. I was looking at what kind of amps he would play. I just like studied all sorts of shit on him, but it was all related to bass playing. He really did not enter my vision at all whatsoever. Outside of the gear realm, quite literally until I saw him like squeezing jizz out of his dick, like the fucking bottom of a rolled out toothpaste, on my newsfeed one day. That was really pleasant. That's been my life with Dave. Yeah.
All right. That's a fair introduction, I guess. David Ellefson has played on songs you like. He was on all of the classic, Megadeth stuff. There essentially is a co-founding member from the early days. So, if you like Rust in Peace, and I assume you do, unless you're being a little contrarian weirdo, he's on that.
He's also on Peace Sells.
Yeah, man. He's on all of that shit until things got real, real weird.
Real weird, right. And then he left the band. And it was kind of like, maybe I'm exaggerating about him coming back into my scope with this latest scandal, because there was that little bit of exciting news of him coming back to the band. And metal fans, they love to have this really hard theory where if you bring back members that were previously in the band during the good albums, if you bring them back, you're going to make good albums again, We hear
it's,
that shit.
It's almost like superstition when you're watching sports.
Right.
Like, if your team scores a touchdown while you're in the bathroom, you have to stay in the bathroom the rest of the fucking game.
You have to wear green, you have to eat brown, you have to drink yellow, or else the Philadelphia Eagles will lose in the Super Bowl.
Exactly.
They will anyway.
And if they fail, it is on you. Cosmically, you caused that to happen.
Right. I mean, I get in trouble all the time on the internet because I love to say Cliff Burton would have cut his hair. Cliff Burton would have played on load. He wouldn't have given a shit. Like, if he left the band and came back, you would have had more sin anger. It's just, it was a guy who was in this huge band just playing bass. Great bassist, had many cool things to write, but Metallica made amazing metal songs that he has no writing credit on. It wasn't just him. It was the fucking time period they were in, and people refused to believe that. So you bring a guy like Dave Ellison back into the band, and everybody's in their 40s and 50s, they're going to write shitty old dude rock. It's just what's going to happen.
I mean, it's kind of like Cormac McCarthy. You can't stop what's coming. Load was inevitable. Saint Anger was inevitable, and it doesn't even matter like who the parties were. This is just how the universe is unfolding. Anyway, so getting into this book, I want to say that the book has a really interesting layout, in that all of the headers are in Bleeding Cowboy. Every
I saw that.
Yeah, it's
the coolest of fonts,
and like. The paragraph indention for the first letter of every chapter is also in Bleeding Cowboy. It like doesn't even work on the layout. Like these letters get cut off. So if you have trouble reading, it's like, well, I guess I got to sound it out, figure out what that word's supposed to be.
Oh, like that? There's like, okay, so there's accents on the Bleeding Cowboy font that get cut out in the publishing.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's so cringe, man.
Well, and let me just like fully flesh out this picture, because it's not just the Bleeding Cowboy, man. So every chapter begins with a quote. Most of these quotes are things that you would hear in recovery programs or things that you would read in the Bible. There is a very very special one here, and I apologize because I'm losing my place in the book a little bit. Chapter 2, titled "One is Too Many and a Thousand Isn't Enough." The quote here: "The best way to never have to quit taking drugs is to simply never start taking them." This quote's a little bit different, and then it's attributed to a person that would be Donald Trump.
Famous not drug user Donald Trump.
Right. I know that he doesn't drink. He's a teetotaler because like his brother was a fucked up alky, right?
Yeah.
I believe his voice is the way it is because of the 70s and 80s. I could be wrong on that. I don't know if there's any photographic evidence of him, you know, going to town on some fat lines. But I know in my heart that's the case.
President Sniffles, huh? You know, like.
Yep.
He's the guy with the opinions on drugs we need.
Like, and if it's not like shit you're buying off a dealer, like surely some pretty fucked up prescribed stuff, right? Like you saw the doctor that he had, who's the guy from Twin Peaks, essentially, right?
Oh yeah, like that balding, weird haired, like old weirdo. Ugh.
Like a total acid casualty that just has a script pad that's like completely out of pages.
And people forget Trump's goons like broke into his office and took his files and that was it.
I did forget that.
No one ever followed up on that story.
This book was published in 2013, so a good ways away from Donald Trump becoming inconceivably the president of the United States of America. But at the time, he was causing a big stir for being a huge fucking asshole all the time. He was the birther guy at the time, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think in 2013, that was right around that time.
Yeah, it's a show me the documents. Well, here's the documents. You're black. So this one just really stuck out to me as an odd choice. Continuing the odd format of this book is that every chapter concludes with thoughts where David Ellison attempts to kind of assemble the things that he's told you into a narrative that makes sense for his path in life. Maybe some advice in there too, if you're, you know, trying to figure out what you should be doing with your life. But an especially interesting bit is that every chapter includes at least one quote from a friend or associate. It's in a little gray box. It has the Bleeding Cowboy header where it says, you know, this is, for example, one of these is Frank Bello, and in parentheses, bassist for Anthrax, where they include a quote where this person says something generally very positive about David Ellison's character. And closing that little box is a picture of David Ellison's signature Jackson bass that was just announced, I believe, right before this book was published. At one point in the book, he calls out, like, hey, you can see the picture of my new bass. You should go check it out.
Oops.
Always hustling, never not grinding. God damn, I just realized that the if you open up the book to the title page, there is the picture of that Jackson bass in much bigger details. You know, it doesn't include where you can call a dealer to get one delivered to you, but it might as well have.
www.sweetwater.com.
The only citations included in this book are from selected scripture quotations taken from the Holy Bible New International Version. So there's not a lot of hard research in this one, but that's okay. We're going from the gut here. The book, as all of these do, opens with a foreword from someone in the industry. If you're reading a book about a musician that has uncovered sobriety, inevitably, the foreword will be from Alice Cooper, as is the case here.
Man.
It fits in with the reformed rocker / metal guy who's now is a big Christian. It checks out.
Thankfully, the foreword on this one is very brief, I assume, because Alice Cooper had done 40 of these by now.
I endorse this product or person.
Exactly. Fucking the Krusty the Clown of former burnouts.
He just has like one in the can that he sends to everybody. He just changes the names around.
Insert name here is left in.
What is the word? What is the phrase for it? Like annotated but not read, or like dictated but not read. Yeah, that's what it is. Hard rock can sometimes take people to many dark and unexpected places. David Ellison has traveled down this rough road for many years. Like many of us, he has been to hell and back. There are sometimes immense outside expectations for rock stars to be dangerous, mysterious, and self-destructive. Some of us get through it sober, but unfortunately, many of us burn out and die before our time. It's a difficult thing to endure without help. David was able to see what was happening to himself and to those around him. He accepted that he needed help, and he is now living his life the way he wants to. Ironically, sometimes the most rebellious and controversial thing a rocker can do is become a Christian. And I don't know if that's the case. Maybe that was the case when Alice Cooper did it, but I feel like this is so, like, rote. I don't know if this is, like, a dangerous and rebellious thing to do anymore.
How many billions of people in the world are Christian?
Too many. No, that's fine. Christianity is fine. I have no problems, right? The book begins, again, as every biography has to, with a prologue saying basically what their darkest moment was for Ellison. It's him getting ready to play the Monsters of Rock Festival at Castle Donington. He had just flown from the U.S. to the U.K. where he could no longer score heroin, so he was extremely dope sick and puking a lot, and suddenly everybody in the band realized, oh, this guy's on drugs. And he was very embarrassed about that, but ultimately it was fine. Everything went fine. He just puked a lot and played the show. But that was the hardest moment for him, I guess, because he had mostly presented that he was okay the entire time, and now everybody knows. Everybody knows you're high, man.
Right. I love it when you have a memoir like this where you write about how your darkest moment in your life is in the rearview mirror, and it's like, motherfucker, you're still here. I can't wait till you find out what happens next.
That is, I guess, the really the dangerous part about writing one of these biographies when you still have a lot of life left to live.
Right. As we see here with Elvson.
Because, you know, in the back sections of the book, he mentions getting back together with Megadeth and how it's the happiest he's been in, you know, forever. Oh, and, you know, no. Everything is smooth sailing from here. And you just can't write that shit. You're tempting fate, my man.
No.
He's just going to have another book to write when this is all done, isn't he?
I guess you would. I guess it depends on how well this original one sold, whether another publishing company will give him a chance or not. I don't know how book writing works, but I assume that it's just as crooked and fucked up as the music industry, right? Like, you get an advance, and if you don't sell enough copies of your book, you have to pay it back. That's what I thought, anyway.
Yeah,
or outside groups just buy your book in bulk, and you force your way onto the New York Times bestseller list. That's how a lot of people do it.
That is true. It's a really... interesting wrinkle of the book selling industry, and I wonder if the megachurch that the Megadeth basis was a part of didn't buy a few copies of this themselves.
Maybe two or three. Yeah, it's like anything, really. You have to pay a lot of money up front for people to pretend you have talent, and they just, you know, shove your cash in their pockets, and you don't get results, and you don't ever find out why.
It's cool. I like the commerce of art. I think that's a cool business overall. Again, as we're keeping with treading some really well-worn ground here, after we've covered our Alice Cooper foreword, after we've done our introduction that includes, you know, how, you know, your artist was really fucked up and realized that things weren't so great, we're going to go flash backwards and we're going to talk about our early childhood.
Right.
Generally, this is the least interesting part about any artist biography. In the case of Jeremy Spencer's book, who was like huffing paint and shit when he was a very young child, that one was pretty interesting. His book overall was very interesting, if it didn't, you know, make you like, you know, scream from being uncomfortable. This one's a little bit stranger. David Elfson was born on a farm in Minnesota. He notes that, you know, his family was doing pretty well when he was a kid. He doesn't try to sugarcoat it, saying like, you know, we were working class or whatever. It was a working farm that he lived on, but they were also doing pretty well in those days, enough so that his dad built an indoor pool, which he mentioned, like, his house was the only family in the county that had such a thing.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty baller, right?
It's gotta be. I know very rich people who keep their pool outside, you know.
That's where you're supposed to put it. That's an outdoors thing.
Right.
Jordan, have you ever known anybody that had an indoor pool?
I don't think so. I think the only indoor pools I knew of in existence were like ones at hotels.
Yeah, or like, you know, a natatorium or something, you know, where it's like a sports thing or whatever, but this was just a chilling pool because I guess it's cold outside in Minnesota. So from an early age, you know, this is standard fare for these books. He discovers a love for the rock and roll, but it's just about the music. He doesn't care about any of the other shit. He just wants to be a cool rock and roller. His family is pretty strict Lutheran, but by the time the 70s roll around, and this is something that I've heard from the older cohort, I didn't necessarily see it myself, but by the time the 70s roll around, the adults within, you know, families, they're partying hard, right? Like 70s parents, they partied is what I'm being told.
Yeah, it's like a lot of people, I go on to Zillow just for killing some time and looking at all the houses for sale in my area. And almost all of them are like stuck in the 70s. They haven't been updated since. And they all have bars in the basement.
Which is, it's a cool look. It's a cool setup, you know? At Ellison's family farm and the grand house or whatever with your indoor pool and your nice bar in the basement or whatever, like, and the 70s rolled around, his parents started partying. They, and as was the case, then you would take your kids with you, you know, down the street to the neighbor's house to, you know, get loaded up or whatever. He mentioned that, like, I think the first time that they took them out to a party with them, his parents were having a great time. They were in a better mood than you ever seen them. And then they pulled over to the side of the road so they could both puke, which is kind of funny. And then, like, a page later, he's like, and then one time my parents had a party at our house. After we went to bed, we woke up the next morning and we're told that one of the guests drowned to death in the pool.
Like, yeah, like, just having constant strange people being super loaded up around your children seems like a really safe environment for them.
They didn't know at the time. We had to learn some things. He does not focus on this section at all. It's just an aside mention, but, like, I find this bit maybe more horrifying than anything else in the book.
Just like you had one of your house guests to your rich, swanky little house there just die horribly. I don't know. I wonder who they paid to just drag the body out.
I don't know.
Local police officers?
I think that was the case, actually.
Boo.
Anyway, Ellefson, he's wanting to live the rock and roll dream, and his parents, despite being, you know, Lutherans that are pretty strict and they're, you know, lifelong farm people, they're very receptive of this, which is interesting because when Ellefson wants something, like, for example, he was listening to a lot of Kiss and he saw that the guys in Kiss were playing Gibson instruments. He's like, well, I want the same amp that Gene Simmons used, and I want the same guitar that he uses. And so for his first bass and first amp, he gets it. Later on, as he's in his teens, like, he decides that he wants a Rickenbacker, he wants a BC Rich, and, like, his dad gets it all for him. His dad converts one of the sheds to be like a practice space. He buys a full PA system for the kid. He gives him a van and gets him a trailer to, like, tour playing teen rock clubs around the area. Like, this is a level of, like, familial, like, acceptance and permission that I could have never dreamed of.
Well, it's interesting because we always bring up how, like, the working class musician doesn't exist anymore, but it was probably pretty rare back then too. Most of these guys weren't starving artists. They had support. They had money from the get-go in order to just throw shit at the wall until something stuck for them creatively in terms of a career.
That's kind of the case where Ellefson, you know, befriends, he plays music with a lot of people. And they're maybe from a little bit more meager means, but, you know, they're more than happy to play with the guy that has everything that can kind of make that happen. And as Breno, I think you and I were talking about a few weeks back, like, if you don't have money, you need to find that guy.
Yeah, you really just need the financial support. If you can't record something that just sounds good in your bedroom, like everybody says you can, like, yeah, you can do that, but you need to have $12,000 of equipment minimum for it to even sound like anything on the radio at all. It's not just your laptop.
You need a trailer. You need a guy that can bankroll, you know, food and spots to stop if you can't sleep in the van, right?
Yeah, for sure. If you don't have the financial support, whether that's somebody who believes in you or it's just your own finances from growing up in a well-off household like Ellefson did, I mean, good fucking luck. It's probably not happening.
Now, it's worth noting that he does have a short paragraph in the book where he says, like, you know, well after he had left the house and the 80s were roaring through, that some farm bill that it was a tariff that Reagan implemented, like, completely crushed the prices of their of the crops they were producing and led to the family losing most of the farm that they had, which of course led to foreclosure of a dream. It's I always wondered about that song. I always dug that one. I was like, what is this deal about farming? I don't understand it. And he did specifically call out like Reagan policies, but he didn't seem bitter about it at all. He's weirdly apolitical in that way.
He took "This Is the News" literally.
Yeah, that's what he does. He has a section later on in the book where he kind of talks about his approach to politics, to not having any politics at all. And it is like the 95 thesis of centrism.
When I come across those people, I'm like half jealous and half utterly stunned that people can actually be like that. Like they don't have an opinion one way or the other about most things.
I don't understand it at all. It's alien to me. And you know what? It's fine if you believe that way. It's the people that like are evangelical about not having beliefs that really get my goat though.
Yeah, but you find with the people who claim themselves as centrists, and it's like, well, I just need to hear out both sides. And like, it always seems to go a lot of one way rather than the other. I mean, you're going to find that their opinions on just about everything are conservative.
Oh, yeah.
That's middle conservative. Yeah, always, fucking always. Because, I mean, a lot of these things that people just call as like political, or they just write off as political debates, you know, I mean, we get into this all the time, but it's just like, man, some of it's just like real, genuine moral stuff, like human choices you should be making to be better. And if you are the kind of person where you're just like, okay, now let's hear from the people who say that all these people should die. Maybe they have a good idea. Like,
let's hear from the nice white gentleman holding tiki torches.
Right, exactly. I hate it.
The closest that Ellefson comes to describing any kind of politics that he has personally is that he considers himself somewhat socially liberal, but very, very fiscally conservative, which would, you know, that is essentially what I guess the right-wing Democratic Party is, right? Like, it's, I mean, that is the air we breathe. That is pretty much how life goes, right? So to say status quo works, it's fine. He doesn't really want to delve into it any further than that. The thread that connects this book all the way through is the notes section in the last section of each chapter, how he makes sense of the things that happened. And that he really has the evangelical mindset where everything that he does and everything that happens to him is a part of God's grander plan for him, and that there are no coincidences. Everything that has happened or will happen to him is a tightly divined plan that leads it to him. So when he's a teenager and all he wants to do is rock and roll, and of course he's from the middle of fucking nowhere, Minnesota, he decides, I need to go out to LA. I need to go to LA because that's where the rock and roll is right now. And I want to be a rock and roller. So that's where I go. I got to go. As soon as I graduate, that's what I'm going to do. And he, you know, definitely puts that in his mind. Like, this is what God planned for me. Like, he told me that I need to make my way to LA, and I followed his plan. And I can see if you were very spiritually minded, that would make sense, and it wouldn't just be you're 18 and you're tired of being on the fucking farm and you want to go where like the cool things are.
It's a great point, right? It's just how he could be going off about the fact that, oh, this is what the Lord wants for me. The Lord wants me to go out where there's these big titted ladies and coke to snort for anywhere I want it.
Yeah, like the Lord made me watch that White Snake video. So yeah, he and some of his buddies from the band that he was playing in Jackson, Minnesota, they all pile into the nice new van with trailer that Dave's parents bought for him, and they go out to the coast his plan, the way he convinced his parents that this was a good thing to do, was that he was enrolling in the Base Institute of Hollywood.
Well, that sounds reasonable.
Definitely not made up.
I can't believe that's a real thing, but yeah, it apparently was. It might still be around for all I know, but essentially a way to, you know, steal a few extra bucks from suckers that want to go out and just get washed away in the incredibly exploitative Sunset Strip scene.
Base Institute of Hollywood.
Pretty. So, you know, they get there. The Base Institute helps them find a Hollywood apartment nearby. And he and his buddies from Minnesota are out there, and they see this real crazy looking guy with long hair and piercings walking around Hollywood barefoot. And they, like, you know, they kind of snoop on him a little bit, and they realize that he lives in the same apartment complex just above him. And they hear him playing music. So they start, you know, kind of hassling him. eventually they ask the guy, like, hey, can you buy us some beer and cigarettes? And the guy relents and, like, lets him in. Turns out, you know, it's old Dave Mustaine. Old Dave Mustaine is up there living above him. And Dave had just been released from Metallica and was in an incredibly bitter spot that thankfully he would grow out of.
He was never complaining about it ever again.
Exactly. And they were listening to him talk about this, and their first question is, who is Metallica? It was just a total... you know, a total circumstance thing that they encountered this guy who had just gotten kicked out of his up and coming band, and was looking to get revenge. Dave agrees to start playing music with these guys. And pretty soon, the other Minnesota guys, they wash out. They realize, this is not working for me. We got to go back to the farm. This shit kind of sucks. Ellison has more of a savings, and he has and more importantly, a credit card that his parents gave him. So he's able to hang for a while.
As anyone who hangs in LA manages to do, it's daddy's credit card.
It's daddy's credit card, folks. You can't leave home without it.
Right. It's like, there it is in print.
So, you know, things get rough for a little. It takes some time for Megadeth to get off the ground. You know, he's starting head and shoulders above everybody else, and that people know who Dave Mustaine is, and they're interested in what he's going to do next, because when they go to shows together, people know him. They're, like, talking about, you know, what Metallica's up to and, like, what Dave's going to do in return. So there's excitement for this. There is – you can't – you starting your band right now, you will never have this amount of buzz.
Yeah, it's like there was a literal music scene there. That's what a music scene is. It's not whatever we're whining about how ugly we feel today on Twitter. That's not the music scene. The music scene was like, hey, man, like, we all liked Metallica, but they kicked out their guitarist. But, oh, shit, have you heard that guitarist? He's starting a new band. We got to go check them out.
We didn't sit around saying bolt thrower back and forth to each other every day.
They might have done that. I don't know.
I can't stress this enough. The time that you spend shitposting, you could spend getting better at your instruments. That's my old man statement of this show. So, you know, the band is starting to make things happen. They go on their first little tour with Exciter. And actually, I think I sent the one of the flyers from that first tour to you guys in the chat the other day. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, and the flyer included a little treasure map of how to get to the place, which I always appreciate.
It's the cutest thing in the world. It's all hand-drawn. A lot of words are not spelled quite right.
One time when I saw Fuck the Facts, they played the, like, Relapse Contamination Tour with Face Down and shit, and I think Jucifer. And I had finished up work and went to get myself something to eat. And the guy working behind the counter knew I listened to metal and ended up drawing me a treasure map to find this place because the show was in an abandoned warehouse. So I identify a lot with this flyer.
Were you able to find it with the treasure map?
Eventually, yes.
Eventually. That's the kicker, isn't it?
Well, it was one of those things where it's like, make a left here. And it's just like, make a left where? There's nowhere to make a left except for this alley. And that's like, oh, that alley is where this is. Okay.
Yeah, The Ask a Punk is a poor substitute for the treasure map. Punks don't know their left from their right. They have to put their hands out in front of them to see which one makes the L. the other guys in the band at this point are jazz guys primarily. And as they are jazz guys, they are deep into heroin. and they convince Dave that heroin is actually a pretty cool time. Which is a thing that they should not have done in retrospect, perhaps, because Dave takes to heroin pretty well. He was a drinker before he got to Hollywood, but then he started drinking, and then he started smoking pot, and then he started doing cocaine, and then he realized that he could come down off cocaine a lot better with heroin. It's kind of a vicious cycle with all these things. Again, I feel like the way that he demonizes pot in this book is maybe like just association with the other shit that he was doing. I don't think it's the same. I don't know. What are your thoughts? Pot and heroin, are they synonymous?
As the expert on mind altering substances of the show, they're quite different. One makes you very, very sick. It gives you a very bad time. I mean, a very good time, but that just leads to a very bad time after the fact if you don't keep rolling with the good times. Marijuana has never done anything for anybody except resulted in, some snacks and a really great night of sleep. So I don't know, a little different maybe.
Well, later in the book, when he's reflecting on his sobriety, he's like, it doesn't bother me that like I set up a festival with Jägermeister as the sponsor. Like, it's fine if other people are drinking. I can deal with that. At the same time, I won't book shows with bands that I know are going to be smoking a lot of pot because I don't want to get a secondhand buzz or whatever. Okay. This is a very odd way of looking about it, but this guy's pretty militant about his sobriety now. I don't think it's necessary to get into the story of how Megadeth is moving forward from there because he doesn't really focus too much on it itself. It's, things happen. We write some songs. We tour. It goes well. It doesn't go well. For the first many years of the band, he's essentially homeless. He's staying with people. He's sleeping in studios. At one point, he gets a girlfriend who is a sex worker. She's, got more money than he does because she's working. And the way that he writes about her in this book is really incredibly shitty to me. He looks down on her and the way that she provided for the both of them. He wrote that, he realized when they were dating that she had done a scene with John Holmes, and he was like, "Ah, man, how am I going to compete with that?" or whatever. And then later on, he was like, "Thank God I didn't get AIDS." And it's just a very it's a very shitty way to look down on somebody who had taken care of you for so long. He doesn't really focus on it much from there. And the only other thing that he says about this is like, finally the band takes off. He's making a little bit of money, so he dumps her. But he was like, "Yeah, I never, even though we were in a band that, we had women going to shows and stuff like that, I never fucked around on anybody like when I had a girlfriend." So again, a big, huge shift in character from what we have in the book to what we've seen lately.
Recently, right? Yeah, I mean, it's just like behind every musician is someone who actually pays the bills.
Seriously.
And Dave Ellefson is the prime example of this. I mean, he's a decent bass player. He's a good bass player. People regard him as a decent bass player, but he's not Megadeth. He was not the farmer who raised that fucking amazing farm that he got to, enjoy all the splendor of in having his music funded. And he wasn't out there fucking turning tricks just so they could eat at, any given night.
No, he was busy like doing heroin with his friends and playing bass instead of like, working for a living.
Right. He couldn't flip a single fucking patty anywhere instead of just like letting this poor woman pay for everything. And then, going off about how she could have, "Good thing I didn't get AIDS. Fuck that. I'm out of here. Thank God Megadeth is making money now. Bye, babe."
Yeah, I think it is the biggest indictment of character in the entire book, because all throughout it, he mentions his amazing relationships with industry people, fellow famous musicians, people in the church, people in the recovery community. Like, he knows all the top guys. He says all the right things to the top guys, and all the top guys have nice things to say about him in return. And reading the way that he treated his girlfriend for so long, it just seems like this is a man that is very transactional in his relationships, even if he would never, ever admit it to himself, that there is something to be cultivated with other people that he can in turn cash in for a favor later. Like when he's working for, after Megadeth breaks up, he works for PV for a number of years doing artist outreach. So he has all these phone numbers. He has all these people he can call, everybody in the industry that he's working with that he can basically, you know, contact and you know, make a little bit of money. Make connections. Remember that, you know, Pastor Dave's the guy with the smiling face who will talk to you when you're down.
Right. And that's where I, in the beginning of the show, that's where I mentioned seeing him, like, as a guy that was getting into gear as a kid. Like, he was on all the PV stuff, going off about PV basses, PV amps, shit like that. So, like, he was still wheeling and dealing years after Anthrax kicked him out. And I don't remember, was he in a different band after Megadeth? I said Anthrax, but I meant Megadeth. Was he in a band after Megadeth?
He was in a band called J5 that he talks about, like, I'm supposed to know what the fuck that is.
J5.
Do you know what that is, Jordan?
It was his solo band, F5.
Yeah. Oh, F5, sorry. F5. Named after after the movie Twister. He mentions that in the book.
It was his favorite key on the keyboard.
He also mentions in the book that the way, and I apologize for not mentioning this earlier because this is very important, that when Dave Mustaine was taking the bus ride home from getting kicked out of Metallica, that he was listening to some speech about mutually assured destruction, and included the word Megadeth, including, which is, you know, used for mentioning the destructive power of nuclear weapons. And the band sat down, and they're originally going to use that as a title for a song, but they sat down and they worked it out using numerology, and that they needed 8 letters because 8 is the numerological component for infinity. Which gives it a lot of symbolism. So they had to drop the A for Megadeth, and then Mega DETH was the perfect band name.
It's like,
why not
the first
say Megadeth sounded cool, so we used it as their band name, and we
but
can't.
There's
spell.
Symbolism, Jordan.
Yeah, everyone thinks of Megadeth when it comes to symbolism.
Exactly. Everyone's like taking out their charts, seeing numerology, like, ah, the perfect band name.
It's like you got that meme where the Gundam is shooting something above some guy's head, and he looks at it and goes, cool robot. But with Megadeth, they're shooting symbolism above our heads, and we're just like, wow, cool skeleton.
So yeah, the band, they're making some strides. They're getting bigger tours, even though due to their, it's, he mentions that basically everybody in the band is pretty fucked up all the time, but he does not say anything in the book about any kind of substance use by Dave Mustaine, which I feel like was a request from Mustaine himself.
Smart legal maneuver. Yeah.
So at various moments, people are, you know, getting too fucked up, or their addictions are too deep. So band members are dropping like flies constantly. And they're, you know, it's really the two Daves that are the core component throughout. And they're going through a revolving cast of rhythm guitarists and drummers who all eventually either succumb to some kind of addiction or getting sick of Dave Mustaine's shit. he does mention that, you know, by the time that they're doing the biggest tours, they're going around, the highest earning year, he made $500,000, which is a pretty fair amount of money. I really thought 80s rock star guys were making more money than that, though. What do you think?
I mean, 500 grand back in the 80s. I don't think did the move for inflation, right?
That's true. I didn't consider inflation at all. He was saying this in the context that, like, he did not pay taxes for a number of years, and he had taken out some personal loans from Dave Mustaine's publishing earnings when he had spent all his money on drugs. So like that $500,000, like that finally got him in a better place where he was able to pay his tax bill and pay back Dave Mustaine for, you know, all the cash he'd floated him over the years. Yeah, not great.
It's like you said, that transactional thing, like he's sticking around because Megadeth has the money, and I don't know, man. It's like, imagine having to borrow from the bank of Dave.
He's holding that shit over your head every single day, right?
Right. Think of who Dave Mustaine is, like what he's like just on Twitter alone or just based off his interviews. Like I wouldn't take $5 out of that guy's fucking pocket.
To le more interest.
It's a good one. I'll give you a point for that one. Around after the time they're finishing up Rest in Peace, you know, the addiction has gotten really bad, and he decides to go to fix his shit. It takes several tries in rehab, but he finally is able to kind of make it work for him. And the band continues on, where they have, you know, they have a couple of good records after that. I mean, they're not Rest in Peace, but they're pretty good. And then, you know, the late 90s come. And he goes on for a pretty good deal about how they got a new manager that was basically saying that to compete nowadays, you need to let me handle how things go. And we need to focus more on the chorus and less on anything else. And that, of course, resulted in Risk, a record that we actually did, a dedicated show on.
It's that bad, right? It's just like Risk was a bad album. I remembered I had an ex-girlfriend who knew I liked Megadeth, and based on that knowledge alone, she bought me that album, and I had to smile and accept it with grace. And I, you know,
that's why she's your ex-girlfriend.
That's exactly right. But if I smiled and accepted that with grace, then I know that my politeness can get me anywhere in life.
So, I mean, Risk is really kind of the band had, you know, declining returns for a while, but Risk is the one that really put a pen in it, where they lost all the momentum that they had. They had alienated their core fan base quite a bit. And even though that they did a video with Goldberg in it, like it wasn't enough.
They appeared on WCW Monday Night Nitro playing that song.
It's like, how do you feel with Bill Goldberg? How?
Yeah.
So write a song that goes crash him.
Crush him. So it was a tough time in metal. You know, new metal was really making strides. All the old guys were passe, and they were trying to do something to compete, and it just wasn't it, man. It was real bad. Shortly after that, they did The World Needs a Hero. I don't know if I've ever heard a single song on that record. Have you guys?
Motorcycle.
Wait, that one's on The World Needs a Hero?
That's that one, yeah.
All right, I take it back, I have.
Very, very shitty album. And I remember, and this was probably years after Risk. I think this was, we're starting to get into the late 90s, maybe early 2000s. Because I remember it came out when I was a young kid, but still of the age where I could care and buy Megadeth albums, because I bought that one. Because all the magazines were talking about, this is it. This is the return to form. Megadeth is back, and it's the shittiest album.
So I believe right before they put out The World Needs a Hero, the band was in pretty, you know, rough shape. They were mad at their lot in life, and they were having a big discussion in the trailer, like, you know, Dave saying, like, I've had enough of this trying to write, you know, more appealing songs. I'm going back to shredding. And at the time, Marty Friedman said, like, if you do that, I'm out of the fucking band. which is not what I would expect from him. I thought he loved that kind of shit.
Right. Marty Friedman was opposed to shredding. That's just not something I would, like, consider.
I think he wanted to be in a successful band. He didn't necessarily want to make records that would, you know, appeal to an increasingly shrinking fan base.
And that's so interesting, because it's like Megadeth starts failing and stops selling albums because they alienated anyone who would have ever cared about Megadeth. It's like, you're not going to gain new fans from radio play of this shit. There aren't that many. Like, even chin beards have limits, you know?
it doesn't work when you're that established. And you saw it at the same time happening with like Judas Priest or Iron Maiden or even Black Sabbath, like changing your sound, trying to be more appealing in the 90s, and it didn't really work for any of them. I think you could look at a band nowadays like Bring Me the Horizon, who changed early enough in their career where they were able to switch away from the heavy stuff. It's, I think if once you've been around for 15 years and have your legions of fans playing arena shows, you can't make that pivot anymore.
I think you're right on that, exactly. And shortly after the release of The World Needs a Hero, Dave Mustaine said, "I'm out of the band. This band is no more." So Dave returns home to his family where he has kids now. He's like, "Huh, I guess I have to figure out how to be like an adult now." And the book really spends the bulk of its time discussing like him becoming a real human after Megadeth. It's not terribly compelling stuff unless you're really into sober recovery or Christianity, in which case there's a lot for you there. But it's a man that like hasn't taken out his own trash since he was 18, like realizing that he needs to be like a husband and father and really get his personal shit under control. Mustaine, of course, reformed the band, didn't call Dave, Dave kind of soldiered on. He took a corporate job with PV. He was playing in his, cool F5 band and talks a lot about that, and doing various little side projects on the side. And he talks in more detail about doing these little things that nobody gives a shit about, more than he does with some of the stuff with Megadeth. Like, he includes a section about how he worked with the rapper Necro on a track. Do you guys know Necro?
Yeah, that was the like metal rapper, like him and Ill Bill, aren't they?
Yeah.
Jewish brothers from New York that have sort of had a following in metal for like a year or two.
Who the fuck are these people?
I know Necro because I heard a track of theirs at a strip club once that I thought was a really awesome one. And I went home and I listened to it and I was like, this is the most like morally objectionable shit I've ever heard in my life.
I gotta listen to it now. I have to go find that.
Yes, Ron Bronstein, better known by his stage name Necro, best known for ultra-violent rapping and, used a lot of heavy metal, death metal references and lyrics. And I think his logo looked like a death metal logo, like that sort of thing. So it was that blending of genres that cranked out some appeal in the mid-2000s for him.
Well, yeah. speaking of cranking, we're well over time, and sure. This we're talking about Dave Ellefson here in his book. Is there anything major from the book we want to discuss before we kind of wrap things up?
Dave Mustaine and Dave Ellefson did the sober recovering rock star thing. They both moved to Scottsdale, Arizona,
like Alice Cooper.
Yes, he took up golf because that's what you do.
Like Alice Cooper.
He got involved in a megachurch.
Like Alice Cooper.
He and the megachurch guys were so excited to have a celebrity parishioner or whatever. They set him up with his own worship service that they called Mega Life. A celebration of life. They let Ellefson put together his own church band. Ellefson goes off for pages about how, when I was a kid, church was really boring. But now, like, they let you have rock and roll in church, and it's good. And I love this contemporary Christian rock and roll, which I find more grating to the soul than, like, old-ass thousand-year-old hymns.
Michael, row your boat ashore.
Jesus is just so right with me.
No. Oh, no.
And
well,
to conclude it, eventually, after many pained years of silence, Mustaine calls him up to rejoin the band for the Big Four tour in 2010. And after all that, everything was great again.
They all lived happily ever after, the end.
I mean, did they have some big lawsuit where Mustaine owed him royalties, like, during their time apart?
These two have sued each other so many times.
It's like it's up there. It's we're getting up there, and we're probably going to see it again because Mustaine kicked him out over.
Oh, it's this. You're going to absolutely see a fucking lawsuit.
They're re-recording his parts on their latest album.
Ooh, lawsuit.
Lawsuit for sure.
That's a lawsuit. So this book should not have been written because it's going to need to be rewritten again. And then again, after that, after he finds whatever inner peace he needs from going through the last book.
Oh, man. I mean, yeah, like if it's not like memoirs are to be written by people whose lives are over, but I feel like maybe at least wait until your career is like way on the back burner before you start something like that. Like he was still going on with Megadeth and still doing his thing, and you know he ends it off with this like right off in the sunset kind of emotion with it, and then we see what happens.
It seems like a big reason to make this book was to make a quick buck and also show off his new bass from Jackson.
Like everything, right? And yeah. I know he might have grounds for a lawsuit just because he didn't do anything legally wrong. And I still see that fucking take floating around on Twitter where it's just like two consenting adults. And then it's like we talked about several weeks ago, Joe, with that producer saying like, man, you know, going around and fucking 19-year-old girls, bro, that was just rock and roll. That's just what we did in the 70s and 80s. But I see no acknowledgement from any of these people that maybe back in the 70s and 80s, you were 4 years older than the 19-year-old girl, as opposed to 40 years older than the 19-year-old girl.
I mean, if you were Ted Nugent, like it didn't matter. There were not a lot of great examples going about back then, I guess. And right. These guys are definitely stuck in a suspended childhood.
Absolutely. And that's the thing, you know, and here's this guy who just kind of rode on Dave Mustaine's coattails to all of his fame and fortune, really. I mean, he came from fortune. He's had a fucking silver spoon jammed in his dumb mouth his whole life, and every bit of success he's ever had was because somebody was helping his ass out. And I mean, that's a reality for some people. Sometimes you're just born into what you're born into, but if that's how it is, I wouldn't put it in a book.
I don't know what drove this book to be written. I don't think it needed to. It should not have been written. This book should not exist. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. I did my duty. I read the stupid thing. I talked about it on the show. I can throw this in the pile with the other biographies I'll never look at again. I'm going to mail the entire fucking thing to some poor listener. You're going to get all of my shitty highlighted books and you're going to have to fucking deal with it. They're going to be in your living room now.
Right. We're just going to pick some poor random Patreon subscriber to have all of these memoirs sent in a box with broken glasses. We'll just put that in there.
Fuck you.
Jordan, do you have any thoughts before we take off here?
Don't write books. Don't read books.
That's advice we can all follow. All right. It's great being back with everybody. We're in a new era, much like you know, the 2010s return of Megadeth. It's all smooth sailing from here.
My cat has been stuck in the room the whole show. Has she been yowling?
I couldn't hear a thing.
Good girl. All right, everybody. Keep it metal. Keep it safe. And hey, go out to some shows. Have some fun. And we will see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
There she is. I got a nose for white supremacy and he smells like bleach. We'll be right back.
You're listening to 66.6 FM. Radio TOVH. The Flush.
I guess it's cranking time!